Hello. We resume our work in chapter 18 of The Life Divine, The Evolutionary Process, Ascent, and Integration. Sri Aurobindo has been describing how it is that the elements of consciousness and power emerge out of a inconscient swoon in which they're based in material encasement. How rung after rung of evolution occurs, driven by nature, until finally, when we get to the human stage, evolution can become conscious, can become intentional. So this evening, we need to carry forward with his argument. I think we'll complete the chapter next week. But here we'll see at least the first two iterations of how the mind works, the mind as it works in matter and the mind as it works in the life force. He continues. But here we have to observe two particularities of this human and at present highest development, which bring us to the heart of the matter. First, this taking up of the lower parts of life reveals itself as a turning downward of the master eye of the secret evolving spirit, or of the universal being in the individual, from the height to which he has reached on all that now lies below him, a gazing down with the double or twin power of the being's consciousness force, the power of will, the power of knowledge, so as to understand from this new, different, and wider range of consciousness and perception in nature, the lower life and its possibilities, and to raise it up, it also, to a higher level, to give it higher values, to bring out of it higher potentialities. Remember that the original title of this essay, when it appeared in the Arya, was The Ascent and Its Downward Eye. There is no possibility of an evolution of consciousness unless consciousness preexists, if consciousness is an innate aspect of being. That consciousness can involve itself, but does not lose itself in its involvement, in its involution into matter. And so it is this consciousness leaning from above with a downward eye, gazing into the depths of the encasements of matter, life in matter, mind in living matter, that stirs one element after the other to rise. All of them expressive of the power of the spirit. And what is spirit but Sat-Chit Ananda, an existence which is conscious and in pursuit endlessly of secret delight. So, will, knowledge, both of them powers, extending from the power of the spirit, Chit Shakti, gazing from above to awaken its own kindred elements from below, tickling them out of inertia, tickling them out of the inconscient, to rise and get moving, saying, the time has come. It is now the auspicious hour. You must begin. So here, we're dealing with the human casement. As all of this occurs within him, the human, Sri Aurobindo calls the man here in the old way of using the English language. Let's continue his argument. And this he does, because evidently he does not intend to kill or destroy it, but delight of existence being his eternal business and a harmony of various strains, not a sweet but monotonous melody, the method of his music. He wishes to include the lower notes also, and by surcharging them with a deeper and finer significance, get more delight out of them than was possible in the cruder formulation. So even here, consciousness force has an urge to delight buried within it, which it must unpack from being. Still in the end, he lays on them as a condition of his continued acceptance, their consent to admit the higher values. And until they do consent, he can deal harshly enough with them, even to trampling them underfoot, when he is bent on perfection and they are rebellious. And that indeed is the true inmost aim and meaning of ethics, discipline, and eschesis: to lessen and tame, purify and prepare to be fit instruments the vital and physical and lower mental life, so that they may be transformed into notes of the higher mental and eventually the supramental harmony, but not to mutilate and destroy them. Ascent is the first necessity, but an integration is an accompanying intention of the spirit and nature. So he began the paragraph by saying two particularities, and these are they: ascent and integration. So we try to coax into conscious consent the elements of life, a reluctant material nature to participate and engage deliberately in the evolution. Until we get that, we use the will force that's available to us to move forward, even riding roughshod over our elements if we must. And ethics arises as a yoke that we put on until we get the instrumental conversion that natural evolution demands from us. So ethics, then, is a yoke which can, when this conversion becomes complete, be dispensed with, because it limits us to a dualistic view, and the good of ethics is not the good of the divine. But temporarily, we'll use it. We're not going to get rid of it prematurely. Ascent is the first necessity, he writes, but an integration is an accompanying intention of the spirit and nature. So as we rise to higher realm, we have to take the values natural to that and incorporate them, integrate them, digest them, assimilate them at every level of our being. If mind enters the picture, well, it has an impact on the way we live. It has an impact on the structure of the body. We saw in last week's portion of the essay that Sri Aurobindo noted that when the evolution occurs and the human begins to emerge out of the animal belt, he condescends to give up many of his natural powers so that they can have access to the mind. It's worth it in the exchange, but we lose our speed, we lose our agility, we lose much that is spontaneously available to us, and we have to study and devise ways by which we can recapture those lost powers through an extension of mentality. So, to continue, this downward eye of knowledge and will, with a view to an all-round heightening, deepening, and subtler, finer, and richer intensification, is the secret spirit's way from the beginning. So this is something that a secret supernature wishes to achieve through the apparent processes of a lower nature, an external nature. And now some vivid examples. The plant soul takes, as we may say, a nervous material view of its whole physical existence so as to get out of it all the vital physical intensity possible. For it seems to have some intense excitations of a mute life vibration in it, perhaps, though that is difficult for us to imagine, more intense relatively to its lower rudimentary scale than the animal mind and body in its higher and more powerful scale could tolerate. So we look at the plant as being insensate. It doesn't have a voice, but it feels and vibrates intensely. And in some ways, the intensity is such that the animal could no longer possess that and survive. It should then arise within our cognition that if plants so feel the world around them, that we ought to be a little kind, that we ought to be a little gentle and look at them as companionable creatures that we're here to nurture and not run over. The animal being, he writes, takes a mentalized sense view of its vital and physical existence so as to get out of it all the sense value possible, much acuter in many respects than man's as mere sensation or sense emotion or satisfaction of vital desire and pleasure. So, a simple sentence, but it says much about the whole belt of animality and how, again, there is great life force there. An enjoyment, a range of pleasures, a sense of adventure that they possess too. Man, looking downward from the plane of will and intelligence, abandons these lower intensities, but in order to get out of mind and life and sense, a higher intensity in other values, intellectual, aesthetic, moral, spiritual, mentally dynamic or practical, as he terms it, by these higher elements, he enlarges, subtilizes, and elevates his use of life values. He does not abandon the animal reactions and enjoyments, but more lucidly, finely, and sensitively mentalizes them. This he does even on his normal and his lower levels, but as he develops, he puts his lower being to a severer test, begins to demand from it on pain of rejection something like a transformation. That is the mind's way of preparing for a spiritual life still beyond it. So he's given us examples of how consciousness works in plant, animal, and the human. And now how bending our appetite and inclining to a discipline to govern ourselves is a nascent preparation for a future spiritual life. It's our first ascesis, that word that Sri Aurobindo uses from time to time, borrowed from the Greek. You know, the term ascetic comes from it, and it means to use with great force a principle of behavior which is not common. But man not only turns his gaze downward and around him when he has reached his higher level, but upwards towards what is above him and inward towards what is occult within him. So now we have a larger picture of the universe. Not only are we engaged with incorporating the lower elements of evolution into our growing mentalization, but we have to become aware of what transcends, what is above, what is superconscient to us, what is within, what is subliminal behind the lines of our outer vision, mind, life, and body, because there are inner planes, which he has described, that are far greater, more luminous, inspirational. And if we can open to them, they can pour their riches and treasures into our formative mind and enhance our experience of the world and create greater art, sensitize us to the beauty and the wonder of the world around. In him, not only the downward gaze of the universal being in the evolution has become conscious, but its conscious upward and inward gaze also develops. The animal lives as if satisfied with what nature has done for it. If there is any upward gaze of the secret spirit within its animal being, it has nothing consciously to do with it. That is still nature's business. It is man who first makes this upward gaze consciously his own business. So the animal is satisfied, the human is not. As a kind of aside, you can say that the human is never satisfied, so the human is always restless, never content with his or her own station in things. There's a school of Japanese Buddhism which says, it is because the animals, the squirrel, are in a constant state of satori. They have that automatically. They have kensho, they have enlightenment, they have awakened to what the real thing is, and they just live it instinctively. The human has not got that, and so it's constantly restless, constantly looking. There is a truth in it. We are looking for an enlightenment, but a greater, more inclusive enlightenment, even than the squirrel has. Mm-hmm. So, and we are permitted to do that. In fact, we are challenged to do that. So, for already, by his possession of intelligent will, deformed ray of the gnosis though it be, he begins to put on the double nature of Satchit-Ananda, double nature, consciousness, and force. The intelligent will, remember, is a term that Sri Aurobindo has used as an equivalent of buddhi. In the Sankhyan scheme, the utmost feature of nature, prakriti. And itself, a reflection here in the lower triple world of chit-shakti, that central term of Satchit-Ananda. Because chit is never chit without power. Chit is always instinct with power, shakti. That extended into this triple world below, this world in which unity has been disintegrated, intelligence, consciousness, and will, force, separate. There, they are one. Here, they are divided and are looking for reunification through the ascent of evolution. Very subtle picture of nature. Let's read that again. For already by his possession of intelligent will, deformed ray of the gnosis, knowledge, higher knowledge, though it be, he begins to put on the double nature of Satchit-Ananda, a first essay. He is no longer, like the animal, an undeveloped conscious being, entirely driven by prakriti, a slave of the executive force, played with by the mechanical energies of nature, but has begun to be a developing conscious soul, or purusha, interfering with what was her sole affair, wishing to have a say in it, and eventually to be the master. And of course, to Sri Aurobindo, the Sankhya system, as typically presented in its dualistic form, is not the greater view. Because ultimately there is a ground of being, isn't there, in which purusha and prakriti are secretly one. They are not antagonistic, they are not antinomies, but they are completing poles of one true being, which is conscious and whose nature is delight. He cannot do it yet. He is too much in her meshes, too much involved in her established mechanism. But he feels, though as yet too vaguely and uncertainly, that the spirit within him wishes to rise to yet higher heights, to widen its bounds. Something within, something occult, knows that it is not the intention of the deeper conscious soul nature, the purusha prakriti, to be satisfied with his present lowness and limitations, to climb to higher altitudes, to get a greater scope, to transform his lower nature. This is always a natural impulse of man as soon as he has made his place for himself in the physical and vital world of earth and has a little leisure to consider his farther possibilities. It must be so, not because of any false and pitiful imaginative illusion in him, but first, because he is the imperfect, still developing mental being, and must strive for more development, for perfection, and still more because he is capable, unlike other terrestrial creatures, of becoming aware of what is deeper than mind, of the soul within him, and of what is above the mind, of supermind, of spirit, capable of opening to it, admitting it, rising towards it, taking hold of it. It is in his human nature, in all human nature, to exceed itself by conscious evolution, to climb beyond what he is. Not individuals only, but in time, the race also. In a general rule of being and living, if not in all its members, can have the hope, if it develops a sufficient will, to rise beyond the imperfections of our present very undivine nature, and to ascend at least to a superior humanity, to rise nearer, even if it cannot absolutely reach to a divine manhood or supermanhood. At any rate, it is the compulsion of evolutionary nature in him to strive to develop upward, to erect the ideal, to make the endeavor. But where is the limit of effectuation in the evolutionary being self-becoming by self-exceeding? In mind itself, there are grades of the series, and each grade again is a series in itself. There are successive elevations which we may conveniently call planes and subplanes of the mental consciousness and the mental being. So this is what he's going to describe next. So within each belt, there are places and ranges where the higher principle intersects with the lower, and dot, dot, dot makes connectivity possible. All the inside of nature reaching out into the external. The development of our mental self is largely an ascent of this stair. We can take our stand on any one of them, while yet maintaining a dependence on the lower stages and a power of occasional ascension to higher levels or of a response to influences from our being's superior strata. At present, we still normally take our first secure stand on the lowest subplane of the intelligence, which we may call the physical mental, because it depends for its evidence of fact and sense of reality on the physical brain, the physical sense mind, the physical sense organs. There, we are the physical man who attaches most importance to objective things and to his outer life, has little intensity of the subjective or inner existence, and subordinates whatever he has of it to the greater claims of exterior reality. The physical man has a vital part, but it is mainly made up of the smaller instinctive and impulsive formations of life consciousness emerging from the subconscious, along with a customary crowd or round of sensations, desires, hopes, feelings, satisfactions, which are dependent on external things and external contacts and concerned with the practical and immediately realizable and possible, the habitual, the common, and average. He has a mental part. But this too is customary, traditional, practical, objective, and respects what belongs to the domain of mind, mostly for its utility for the support, comfort, use, satisfaction, and entertainment of his physical and sensational existence. So this is the person who's oriented towards the physical life, towards the body, has a limited range of interests in vitality and a limited range of use of his mind to get at the satisfaction of those limited desires and maintain the security of his physical existence. Now, if you go back and you read Plato's Republic, he describes some of these personalities. This is the fellow who sits in his hut and he's glad to have his stew and his bread. That's enough for him. Thank you very much. Nothing more about the greater world need he know. And there are others, too. The fellow who's going to go to the ale house and drink ale and laugh with the guys, you know, and have a big, vital, exuberant life. That's another kind of guy. Maybe superior to the other, but not the highest man, who would be the philosopher. Who would be Socrates, of course. So, let's go forward. All that is not of this order. The physical mind builds up as a restricted superstructure dependent upon the external sense mentality. Even so, it regards these higher contents of life as either helpful adjuncts or a superfluous but pleasant luxury of imaginations, feelings, and thought abstractions, not as inner realities. Or even if it receives them as realities, it does not feel them concretely and substantially in their own proper substance. Subtler than the physical substance and its grosser concreteness, it treats them as a subjective, less substantial extension from physical realities. It is inevitable that the human being should thus take his first stand on matter and give the external fact and external existence its due importance, for this is nature's first provision for our existence, on which she insists greatly. The physical man is emphasized in us and is multiplied abundantly in the world by her as her force for conservation of the secure, if somewhat inert, material basis on which she can maintain herself while she attempts her higher human developments. But in this mental formation, there is no power for progress or only for a material progress. It is our first mental status, but the mental being cannot always remain at this lowest rung of the human evolutionary ladder. There is an urge put upon us by secret nature to outgrow this. This we must secure. We can't ignore the physical base. We don't need a philosopher lost in a dream world, unable to handle time and place. We have to maintain order in the physical. We have to secure this and keep it in its integrity. Forward. Above physical mind, which he's just described, and deeper within than physical sensation, there is what we may call an intelligence of the life mind, dynamic, vital, nervous, more open, though still obscurely, to the psychic, capable of a first soul formation, though only of an obscurer life soul, not the psychic being, but a frontal formation of the vital Purusha. So, the physical mind on the surface dealing with matter. Now, the articulation of a life mind, which begins to express the psychic essence behind. There is that germ, more than that, there is that entity. There is that presence of the soul within, growing even through this groping animality as it becomes mental, begins to experience and energize in the opening ranges of humankind. And this soul formation that is on the surface at that point is really more connected with the experience of life, but it stands as a kind of soul presence, the soul behind supporting it, at the level of life. This is the Pranamaya Purusha. Sri Aurobindo isn't using this term here. He's calling it the Vital Purusha. But in the old language of the Vedanta, it would be the Pranamaya Purusha, the person centered in the life realm. So if there's an Annamaya Purusha, a person at the body level, and a Pranamaya Purusha, a person at the life level, we can expect that there will be one at the mental level too. I'm sorry to take this quick aside here. That would be the Manomaya Purusha. But the central person, the real conscious soul, is behind all of these, supporting each of these as an extension of its own true self into the experience of nature. That is the Chaitya Purusha, the conscious person within. The closest equivalent Sri Aurobindo could find in Sanskrit for what he called in English the psychic being. We'll get back to that and we'll look at the tessellation of how all these terms are used by him and see if we can unwrap some of it later. So this life soul, this soul as it integrates with life on the surface, is the frontal part of this vital purusha. This life soul, he writes, concretely senses and contacts the things of the life world and tries to realize them here. It attaches immense importance to the satisfaction and fulfillment of the life being, the life force, the vital nature. It looks on physical existence as a field for the life impulse's self-fulfillment, for the play of ambition, power, strong character, love, passion, adventure, for the individual, the collective, the general human seeking and hazard and venture, for all kinds of life experiment and new life experience. And but for this saving element, this greater power, interest, significance, the physical existence would have for it no value. And this all sounds great. If we don't have this, then how does the adventure of life continue? How do we get out of the encasement in physicality? It's very necessary, and in fact, this gusto that the vital has for the experience of physicality, in a sense, lends justification for that being the material basis on which all is staged. This life mentality, he says, is supported by our secret, subliminal, vital being and is in veiled contact with a life world to which it can easily open and so feel the unseen dynamic forces and realities behind the material universe. This is exactly what he was mentioning just a bit ago. This is the interface through that Pranamaya Purusha. There is an inner life mind which does not need for its perceptions the evidence of the physical senses, is not limited by them. For on this level, our inner life and the inner life of the world become real to us independent of the body and of the symbols of the physical world, which alone we call natural phenomena, as if nature had no greater phenomena and no greater realities than those of gross matter. The vital man, molded consciously or unconsciously by these influences, is the man of desire and sensation, the man of force and action, the man of passion and emotion, the kinetic individual. He may and does lay great stress on the material existence, but he gives it, even when most preoccupied with its present actualities, a push for life experience, for force of realization, for life extension, for life power, for life affirmation and life expansion, which is nature's first impetus towards enlargement of the being. At a highest intensity of this life impetus, he becomes the breaker of bonds, the seeker of new horizons, the disturber of the past and present in the interest of the future. He has a mental life, which is often enslaved to the vital force and its desires and passions, and it is these he seeks to satisfy through the mind. But when he interests himself strongly in mental things, he can become the mental adventurer, the opener of the way to new mind formations, or the fighter for an idea, the sensitive type of artist, the dynamic poet of life, or the prophet or champion of a cause. Throw names out there all you like: Keats, Shakespeare, Florence Nightingale. The vital mind is kinetic, and therefore a great force in the working of evolutionary nature. And that's a great place to put a bookmark, so why don't we do that, and we'll finish this chapter next week. So, something from Savitri. If I've been fortunate enough to find a point from which to read. Well, this is this is Canto 3 in Book 2, the Book of the Travel of the Worlds. This is The Glory and the Fall of Life. I think you'll like it. Unshepherded by the fear that walks through time, undaunted by fate that dogs and chance that springs, she accepts disaster as a common risk. Careless of suffering, heedless of sin and fall, she wrestles with danger and discovery in the unexplored expanses of the soul. To be seemed only a long experiment, the hazard of a seeking ignorant force that tries all truths and, finding none supreme, moves on unsatisfied, unsure of its end. As saw some inner mind, so life was shaped. From thought to thought she passed, from phase to phase, tortured by her own powers or proud and blessed, now master of herself, now toy and slave. A huge inconsequence was her action's law, as if all possibility must be drained, and anguish and bliss were pastimes of the heart. In a gallop of thunder-hooved vicissitudes, she swept through the race fields of circumstance, or swaying, she tossed between her heights and deeps, uplifted or broken on time's inconstant wheel. Amid a tedious crawl of drab desires she writhed, a worm mid worms in nature's mud, then, titan-statured, took all earth for food, ambitioned the seas for robe, for crown the stars, and shouting, strode from peak to giant peak, clamoring for worlds to conquer and to rule. Then, wantonly enamored of sorrow's face, she plunged into the anguish of the depths, and wallowing clung to her own misery. in dolorous converse with her squandered self, she wrote the account of all that she had lost, or sat with grief as with an ancient friend. A romp of violent raptures soon was spent, or she lingered tied to an inadequate joy, missing the turns of fate, missing life's goal. A scene was planned for all her numberless moods, where each could be the law and way of life, but none could offer a pure felicity. Only a flickering zest they left behind, or the fierce lust that brings a dead fatigue. Amid her swift, untold variety, something remained dissatisfied, ever the same, and in the new saw only a face of the old, for every hour repeated all the rest, and every change prolonged the same unease. A spirit of herself and aim unsure, tired soon of too much joy and happiness, she needs the spur of pleasure and of pain, and the native taste of suffering and unrest. She strains for an end that never can she win. A perverse savor haunts her thirsting lips. For the grief she weeps, which came from her own choice, for the pleasure yearns that racked with wounds her breast. Aspiring to heaven, she turns her steps towards hell. Chance she has chosen, and danger for playfellows. Fate's dreadful swing she has taken for cradle and seat. Yet pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. Her moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her native right, and endless bliss is her eternal home. Namaste. Jai Ma.